We lived in a torrent of money, and we were constantly deploying it. That was Charlie Munger reflecting on the sheer scale of capital generation at the 2016 Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting.
It is a profound description of financial success, truly.
It is. But consider the implications of a slightly different, perhaps more radical proposition. What if the torrent deployed itself?
Well, that changes the entire paradigm.
Exactly. Welcome to this video analysis. Today, we are undertaking a rigorous exploration of a concept drawn directly from the Averaging Up collection.
And it is a vital discussion for you, the sophisticated investor, to hear.
Our objective is to dismantle the traditional view of capital allocation and really to reveal a hidden hierarchy in the architecture of modern compounding. We are diving deep into the frameworks known as the Coral Moat and the Free Surfer.
Yes. Because to truly comprehend the future trajectory of capital, well, we have to look past the surface-level metrics we have relied on for decades. We are going to examine two permanent iconic holdings in Warren Buffett's portfolio today. These two entities sit side by side on a spreadsheet, and they command identical reverence in traditional financial circles.
But as we unpack the mechanics, we will see they operate on entirely different architectural planets.
Completely different.
The businesses we are analyzing are Coca-Cola and Moody's. So let us start by looking at how traditional financial frameworks create this dangerous blind spot.
The illusion of equivalence?
Exactly.
Yeah.
By grouping completely disparate businesses under the exact same labels, the market loses its ability to price actual risk and structural longevity. I mean, Morningstar, for instance, labels both Coca-Cola and Moody's as possessing wide moats.
Right. They're universally recognized as wonderful businesses.
Yes.
And if you look purely at the quantitative output, well, it is easy to see why that illusion of equivalence exists. If you run a standard financial screen, the results are remarkably similar for both.
They really are.
Both corporations exhibit highly attractive returns on equity. Both boast incredibly wide operating margins. They both generate immense predictable cash flows.
And both return a massive amount of capital to shareholders through dividends.
Precisely. The spreadsheet looks at those metrics and fundamentally sees two variations of the exact same theme. Blue chip compounders protected by impregnable barriers to entry.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because grouping these two together simply because they both have a high ROE is, well, it is like looking at a hot air balloon in a commercial jet and concluding they are the exact same aircraft simply because they both achieve altitude.
That is an excellent way to frame it.
The spreadsheet sees the altitude. It completely misses the physics keeping them in the air.
And that is precisely the structural flaw in traditional equity analysis. Screening metrics only capture visible safety.
Right.
They measure the byproduct of success, the altitude, as you said, but not the engine driving it. By relying strictly on these surface-level outputs, investors render themselves entirely blind to the foundational architectures driving the underlying economics.
Because the legacy framework assumes that a moat is simply a moat, provided it is wide enough.
Exactly.
So let's actually break down how this legacy moat works in practice. To prove the flaw in this framework, we have to look at the first type of foundation, which is the mechanical moat.
And Coca-Cola perfectly exemplifies this.
It does.
Coca-Cola possesses a globally ubiquitous brand. Unquestionably, that brand holds immense value. Worth tens of billions of dollars.
Unquestionably.
However, the critical architectural feature of a mechanical moat is that it requires relentless, massive spending just to exist.
And the scale of that spending is what we need to focus on.
It is staggering. I mean, Coca-Cola requires a $4 billion annual expenditure in advertising, marketing, sponsorships, and promotion operations just to maintain its barrier to entry.
Wait, I want to pause on that figure. Because it is the crucial caveat that the broader market often glosses over.
Oh, absolutely.
That $4 billion is not being spent to grow the business. It is being deployed merely to maintain the present reality.
It is defensive capital.
Right.
Exactly. They are spending it to defend existing shelf space and to fight off a structurally shrinking, health-conscious, addressable market. We are talking about a consumer base rapidly migrating toward water and functional drinks.
Yes.
A shift that is now being fundamentally accelerated by the physiological impacts of GLP-1 drugs.
Right. When you view the economics through the strict lens of compounding capital, the machine is broken.
How so? Let's get into the numbers.
Well, Coca-Cola boasts a 25% return on equity, which appears magnificent on a standard stock screener. Yet its actual top-line revenue growth hovers around a mere 2 to 3%.
So we are looking at a massive structural gap.
A 22 percentage point gap, to be precise. And that gap cannot be profitably reinvested into the core business. The volume growth engine is effectively stalled.
So what happens to the capital?
That surplus cash is recycled back to shareholders as a dividend. It is return of capital, not a return on invested capital.
Right.
The business earns magnificently on its existing equity, but it has absolutely nowhere to deploy the surplus to generate new organic growth.
So if Coca-Cola is spending $4 billion just to tread water, it begs the question, what does this all mean for the moat itself?
It fundamentally changes the nature of the asset.
It deduces that the moat is rented, not owned. If Coca-Cola were to halt that annual marketing expenditure, well, the brand might hold its ground for a year based on sheer nostalgia.
Perhaps 2 years.
But by year five, without that continuous capital injection, premium supermarket shelf space begins to shrink. It risks becoming a regional brand with a fading logo.
Precisely. The moat relies entirely on relentless financial maintenance. It is an artificial barrier requiring constant fuel.
Which brings us to the profound architectural contrast. So if Coca-Cola represents a moat that costs $4 billion annually to rent, what does a business look like that doesn't have to pay a single dollar to defend itself?
And that leads us directly to Moody's. Moody's possesses what the framework defines as a coral moat. This economic barrier is built upon a century of deeply embedded institutional trust.
And it is structurally reinforced by regulatory requirements.
Exactly. Consider the global banking standards, frameworks like Basel III or the Dodd-Frank Act. These regulations implicitly and explicitly require credit ratings from nationally recognized statistical rating organizations, or NRSROs.
Right, and the list of those organizations is incredibly short.
There are only 9 such organizations recognized globally.
9. And the barrier to entry there is practically insurmountable. You cannot simply write a better AI model or launch a well-funded startup to disrupt this oligopoly.
You absolutely cannot.
A superior piece of software cannot replicate a century of established institutional trust, nor can it bypass a regulatory mandate baked into the foundation of global finance.
And what's fascinating here is the counterintuitive brilliance of this specific architecture.
Walk us through that.
Well, a mechanical moat like Coca-Cola's is highly vulnerable to macroeconomic shocks. During a recession, consumers trade down to generic brands, forcing the mechanical moat to spend even more just to defend its territory.
They have to increase the ad spend to fight the down cycle.
Right. The coral moat, however, actually strengthens during financial crises.
Because the immediate regulatory response to a crisis is a demand for more oversight.
Precisely. Following the 2008 financial crisis, you might logically assume a rating agency's credibility would be destroyed.
You would think so, yes.
Instead, the regulatory response was to require more independent credit ratings, not fewer. After every significant credit event, the demand for institutional assessment increases.
The crisis validates the toll bridge.
Exactly. The toll becomes more mandatory, not less.
I want to challenge a phrase you used earlier, though, regarding the cost to maintain this moat. You said it costs zero to own. Now, Moody's employs highly compensated financial analysts in Manhattan and London. They clearly have expenses.
Yes, of course.
Can you clarify what you mean by a zero-cost moat?
It is a critical distinction between operating expenses and capital expenditures for defense. Yes, Moody's pays salaries to execute its daily operations. However, it does not have to spend billions in capital specifically to defend its competitive advantage from rivals.
Ah, I see.
It does not have to buy Super Bowl advertisements to convince bond issuers to use its ratings. The regulatory structure and the embedded trust do that automatically. The maintenance cost of the moat itself approaches zero.
And the financial reality of that architecture is staggering. Let's look at the numbers for Moody's. It boasts a return on equity exceeding 30%, paired with a robust 12% annual revenue growth.
And it captures that growth effortlessly.
Right. It captures structural macroeconomic growth, the relentless global expansion of credit markets, corporate bonds, and sovereign debt issuance, without spending a single dollar of defensive capital to create that volume.
Furthermore, the digitalization of their delivery mechanism means the marginal cost of issuing an additional digital rating approaches zero.
So it is a fundamental growth engine.
Yes. It is a freebie that compounds virtually at infinity, returning massive surplus to shareholders precisely because it costs nothing to maintain the barrier.
This raises an incredibly important question regarding the philosophy of value investing itself.
It certainly does.
If the coral moat is vastly superior structurally and economically to the mechanical moat, If it grows effortlessly while the mechanical moat struggles just to maintain volume, why do traditional value investing frameworks fail to make the distinction?
That is the pivotal inquiry of this entire analysis.
Why did the greatest investor of all time view them as equals?
Well, we are looking at a fundamental historical blind spot in traditional capital allocation. To understand this blind spot, we must break down the newly revealed hierarchy of moats.
Let's walk through those tiers.
The framework identifies three distinct tiers in the modern economy. The base tier consists of sand moats. These are competitive advantages created by an external authority.
Which means they can be dissolved instantly by that same external authority.
Precisely. Consider FICO's old regulatory moat. For years, it was perceived as unassailable, but that moat cracked the moment the Federal Housing Finance Agency approved the use of VantageScore.
Instantly.
Instantly. By a single regulatory signature, FICO was stripped of a massive portion of its perceived terminal value.
A barrier built on sand. Highly profitable, right up until the tide of regulation washes it away.
Exactly. Now, the second tier in the hierarchy is the mechanical moat, which we analyze with Coca-Cola. It is highly durable, it can last for over a century, but it is strictly dependent on continuous, massive financial spending.
Right.
Finally, the apex of the hierarchy is the coral moat, exemplified by Moody's or, say, a payment network like Visa.
Built by usage.
Built by usage, driven by structural economic waves and entirely self-reinforcing. Every single transaction on Visa's network makes the network inherently more valuable to the next user without Visa having to spend additional capital to enforce that loyalty.
The cost of maintenance is zero.
Exactly zero.
Here's where it gets really interesting regarding the historical context. Warren Buffett isn't wrong in his assessment of wide moats. His framework is simply a product of a highly specific era of financial history.
Yes, his investment philosophy was forged during the golden age of mechanical moats.
Spanning roughly from the 1950s through the 1980s.
Right. During that specific macro environment, consumer packaged goods and strong brands were essentially the technology stocks of their day.
They were the ultimate compounders.
They were. The greatest compounding businesses, American Express, See's Candies, Gillette, Coca-Cola, they all grew by aggressively reinvesting capital into physical distribution, product iteration, and brand dominance.
So in that world, every wide moat was a mechanical moat.
Exactly. The concept of a coral moat simply did not exist yet.
It hadn't evolved.
So the terminology and the evaluative criteria became fixed in the academic and professional lexicon. The binary label of wide versus narrow moat was cemented.
But the digital age fundamentally altered the taxonomy of businesses. It birthed the coral moat in the 2000s and 2010s entirely outside the bounds of the original value investing dictionary.
Entirely outside.
Visa's network effect, Moody's digitized institutional trust, MSCI's dominance in equity indexing, these asset-light architectures emerged after the traditional screening frameworks were already universally adopted.
Which means the hierarchy of moats became an undeniable economic reality, yet the legacy vocabulary remained completely static.
And this historical blind spot translates directly into a current, highly actionable reality for you, the listener. Because the legacy vocabulary is static, it dictates precisely how the public market systematically misprices these assets today.
Yes, the market is trapped by its own definitions.
Let us examine this market's pricing trap. We are looking at a severe valuation compression here.
Consider the forward multiples as outlined in the research. Coca-Cola trades at a price-to-earnings ratio of roughly 25. Moody's trades at a price-to-earnings ratio of roughly 29. The market is charging a mere 4-point premium for Moody's.
Which is a mathematical absurdity when you lay out the underlying physics.
It truly is.
The market is asking for just 4 additional points of PE for a business that generates 6 times the top line growth, possesses a self-reinforcing regulatory load, and operates with a negative cost to maintain its competitive advantage.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it exposes the foundational flaw in how public markets price quality today. The market systematically overvalues visible safety.
Because it is easy to model.
Exactly. Coca-Cola provides a visible, easily quantifiable 3% dividend yield. It provides a visible 25% return on equity.
And it provides the visible psychological reassurance of a century-old brand that you can physically touch in a supermarket.
Right. The market happily pays a multiple of 25 for this quantifiable comfort. But the market structurally undervalues the invisible magic of the coral moat.
Moody's deeply embedded institutional trust.
The zero-cost maintenance. Its ability to capture global credit expansion effortlessly. These dynamics do not register as distinct premium inputs in a standard financial screener.
The dividend reassures the spreadsheet, but the coral is silent.
It is silent. The framework dictates this valuation gap should not be 4 points. Given the architectural superiority, the gap should logically be 20 points, not 4.
The compression between a business that merely recycles capital to survive, the mechanical moat, and a business that captures secular growth for free, the coral moat, that is the ultimate pricing trap of the modern market.
It absolutely is.
This realization brings our analysis to its structural climax. We've looked at the granular mechanics of these moats. Now we must zoom out and contrast the absolute ultimate expressions of these two financial architectures.
The two summits.
Yes, the two summits of capital. The torrent versus the free surfer.
Let's outline these two summits. We define the first summit as the absolute pinnacle of the mechanical world, and that is Berkshire Hathaway.
Unquestionably.
The architecture of Berkshire is arguably the greatest mechanical engine ever constructed in the history of finance. It relies on what Charlie Munger termed a torrent of negative cost flow.
Let's translate negative cost flow so the mechanics are perfectly clear for everyone listening.
Please do.
This is the massive accumulation of insurance premiums. Policyholders literally pay Berkshire to hold their cash, assuming the risk of a future claim.
Right.
Berkshire holds that massive pool of capital, invests it, and historically pays out less in claims than it earns.
Mm-hmm.
The timeline is inverted. The cash arrives before the cost of the service.
It is a brilliant, immensely powerful mechanism. But crucially, this architecture requires a master pilot.
It demands human intervention.
Exactly. The torrent afloat is immense, feeding into Berkshire's massive cash reserves. But every single dollar of that torrent requires a human decision for deployment.
It requires a masterful allocator to select the acquisition, to purchase the equity, to price the risk accurately.
And as Munger openly admitted, this reliance on human deployment necessitates the avoidance of standard stupidities.
Because the pilot is the point of failure.
Correct. The architecture absorbs human error because the torrent afloat is so powerful, but the errors are still fundamentally real. The system is only as good as the person making the allocation decisions.
So if we look at Berkshire as an incredibly engineered masterpiece of financial infrastructure, it absolutely requires a genius operator to stand at the controls, constantly deciding when to open and close the floodgates to generate power.
That is the perfect analogy.
Thank you.
Now, consider the second summit, the summit of the natural world, which we call the free surfer.
The free surfer.
This represents a business architecture that captures massive structural economic waves without the need for an operator. We are talking about waves like the digitalization of global payments, the relentless shift toward the indexation of equities, or the expansion of global credit markets.
And the free surfer is simply the tide itself.
Yeah.
It requires no operator. It requires no masterful pilot scanning the horizon for the perfect allocation target. The deployment is automatic. Returning to our opening question, the torrent deploys itself.
Berkshire is paid to receive debt, carrying the inherent risk of future insurance claims and relying on a genius pilot to outcompound that risk.
Right.
The free surfer is paid to receive growth. The structural economic wave delivers the volume directly to the toll bridge. No debt is created. No pilot is required to make a brilliant capital allocation decision.
It is the same fundamental financial gesture, being paid to receive capital, but with entirely opposite architectural natures underneath.
Exactly.
We have dismantled the illusion of equivalence today. We have separated the mechanical from the coral, the visible safety of legacy brands from the invisible compounding engines of the digital age.
And I will leave you with a final forward-looking question to consider based on this architecture.
Please.
Berkshire Hathaway currently sits on a fortress of approximately $340 billion in cash and treasury bills.
An unprecedented number.
It is a scale of capital accumulation that defies historical precedent. So, what happens to the summit of the mechanical world when it reaches a scale where the deployable roads simply run out?
When the pilot, regardless of their genius, can no longer find private acquisitions or public equities large enough to absorb the torrent.
Precisely. As the mechanical world exhausts its deployable avenues at hyperscale, the natural pilotless wave of the free surfer becomes not just an attractive alternative, it becomes a structural inevitability.
To explore these investment strategies further and discover more from the collection, visit the website averagingup.com.